traditionally, dating back through the last century, if not longer, jurors have not been permitted to participate in the presentation of the evidence in a criminal trial. And the lawyers who do participate in presenting the evidence are not given a vote on the jury. It doesn't take a degree in psychology to understand that the perspective of a person who is actively eliciting the evidence is different, or could be different, from a person who is passively absorbing information from both sides and then at the end judging and weighing that evidence. Allowing the jurors to pose their own questions might cause them to think less like neutral judges and more like detectives solving a crime, making connections, poking holes in testimony or theories, and looking for the backstory. I think it's the great American pastime, the whodunit. We've got board games, books, TV shows, and some of the jurors' questions in this case reflect that that desire for the backstory. One of the first questions out of the box for Detective Copeland was a question about whether the defendant was a person of interest, and if so, how long had he been a person of interest?
Let me ask you this. You make a good point, and I think Judge Walton here, if he hadn't screened them, if he hadn't taken all the precautions he had, it might be a risky business. But considering all he did, how is this any different from when a jury in its deliberations sends, and this often happens, as you know, sends a question out that has nothing to do with either the evidence or is an improper question, and it is simply told, that is something that you must not concern yourselves with. It is not a matter for you to decide or for you to opine on. Even something like asking for a dictionary, that can be reversible. And so if the judge is as careful as he was here to make sure that the questions are screened and they're not, if they're not asked, they're not, that's no criticism of the jurors, what the danger is?
Well, I do think that if allowing jurors to pose questions is proper, that this judge did put into place all the prophylactic measures that one should by having, yes,
okay.
Because he had them put it in writing, he instructed them over and over again. But it is very different from jurors' questions during deliberation. Any questions about evidence are answered in the same way. You are the judges of the facts. Your recollection controls. Judges never answer questions about the evidence. They only.
But there are questions that come from jurors that are just off the wall questions that you've got to say. You have that's not a concern of yours. I remember one involving a negligence case, and they came back with question about punitive damages. And punitive damages hadn't even been mentioned in the case, and you have to deal with questions like that. And how is this different?
I think it's different in several ways. One is when they're deliberating, they're supposed to be, weighing the evidence, putting it all together. When they're listening to the testimony, they are not supposed to start deliberating. They're not supposed to start forming opinions.
You mean they're not supposed to start discussing it with each other, but clearly they're thinking about the case, aren't they?
Yes, they're thinking about the case.
They're not just absorbing information and not thinking about what it means to them. Right,
right. And they're certainly making judgments, or at least preliminary judgments, about credibility of the
correct
witnesses. But
so what's the harm then if they have a question to let them ask it, since they're already thinking about the evidence?
Well, I think there's several harms. One is that it engages them in the trial in a very different way than simply being a neutral judger of the facts, someone who in the end will stack up the government's evidence and determine whether it's sufficient to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. That process of stacking up the evidence, having received it all passively, is, I think, very different from getting involved in eliciting the evidence. You know, perhaps challenging witness testimony. I think we see it in this case. Some of the questions from the jurors, particularly to Ms. Holland, were simply matters of clarification. Where were you standing when you saw what you saw? Those kinds of things. The questions to the detectives really weren't. They were more questions about the defendant. They certainly would be considered outside the scope of direct examination and cross-examination of those witnesses. I think that it carries the risk that jurors will feel embarrassed or upset if they feel that, you know, their question should not have been rejected by the court. That might feel like gamesmanship to them. Of course, they see the lawyers, you know, discussing the questions with the judges and might feel that the defense lawyer is the one who is thwarting their pursuit of the truth.
Even if we agree with you that this is a process that is fraught with risk, as almost all the courts that have looked at it have said, and that district courts shouldn't be doing this as a matter of policy, what gives us the authority to say that? That is, where is our authority to say that this is a practice that can never be done, as compared to a situation where it's done improperly, or as compared to a situation which I assume you'll eventually get to, where a question is asked which never should have been asked? No court has ever said that there's a per se rule against this.
Right. We recognize that we are asking the court to establish a per se rule that has not been established by
any
other court.
We don't really have this so-called supervisory authority. The Supreme Court's told us that we have authority to overrule district courts when they violate a constitutional provision, statutory provision, but we can't just generally say this is the practice we would prefer district courts to do.
I think implicit in the Sixth Amendment right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury is the notion that the jurors really are simply the judges of facts. They're not a participant in the trial. So I think it is a constitutional violation. If you look at the rules of evidence, there are very specific rules about jurors. Jurors cannot be a witness in a case.
But all the things you're talking about, and I think you put it exactly right in the way in which you phrase it. They're all sort of probably, maybe, could be kind of problems. The questions that you're talking about, these are ones which the jurors no doubt have in their minds one way or the other, and the only question is whether vocalizing them or putting them in writing changes the juror dynamic in some way from the fact that they're holding it inside their heads. And you say that it doesn't require a psychologist. I'm not sure a psychologist would persuade me that the difference between having a question and writing that question down is the difference between a trial that's fair and a trial that's not fair.
I think, you know, obviously jurors have idle speculation about lots of matters. But actually articulating that in writing, developing your own line of cross-examination is a very different matter, where you become sort of wedded to that. You become wedded to your line of cross-examination. The prosecutor has prepared a line of examination. The defense lawyer has prepared a line of cross-examination. And now here comes 12 more people with their lines of cross-examination, which also raises the issue whether it's a distraction for them. Can they really absorb the evidence while they're, you know, pinning their...
Well, there are a lot of distractions for jurors, and the fact that they're paying close attention, enough attention to ask a question, strikes me as the least concerning distraction that jurors have. I mean, I take your other point that it may commit them to one side or another, but I take it the reason that judges do this is that they actually think it focuses the jurors' attention on the trial in a way that if they're just sitting there, can't ask anything and can't write anything down and can't say anything to anybody else, may otherwise cause them to fall asleep or to close their eyes. Yeah. I just think that there's no way for us to know with a psychologist or not whether this really is a problem.
One point I'd like to make is that it's completely unnecessary. We've had the system for decades, centuries, and it works. We are not facing a situation where we're looking at a flood of unreliable jury verdicts because they were not allowed to pursue their own questioning or correct, perhaps, bad lawyering, or they were not able to stay awake.
Of course, the district judges who do this think it improves the quality of the fact-finding.
Well, maybe they should commission a study to look at that, but I don't think that there's certainly no indication that our jury system is not working. I think that it's working just fine and doesn't need this kind of innovation that, frankly, interferes with trial practice. Trials are governed by rules, and lawyers very carefully limit their examination so that they don't open the door to certain things, as happened in this case.
Well, how about if we focus on the quite troubling question that was asked in this case?
Right. The juror, I think, I actually thought there was sort of an edge to the juror's question. The juror's question was, in what way is leaving a parking lot at 10 to 12 miles an hour, speeding off? But in getting at that, getting the answer to that, the judge asked, what made you follow the car? And that gave the officer an opportunity to say what he had been forbidden to say.
Well, why didn't I quite agree with this. I think this question should never have been asked. It strikes me as an invitation to do exactly what the parties had agreed would not be done. And that seems to me the risk in these juror questions, that the judge won't restrict. But I guess my first question is, why didn't defense counsel object on that ground? It seems obvious, except for the fact that defense counsel was also trying to get the same point in, that there was an inconsistency in the speed. Why didn't the defense counsel say, objection, Your Honor, this opens the possibility of disclosing precisely the prejudicial fact that you've ruled out?
I assume that he didn't recognize that possibility. Once the question was asked and answered, for him to then object to a juror question, poses the dilemma whether he wants to offend.
No, but this was when they were at the bench discussing whether to permit this question. And the defense counsel did object, but on the wrong ground. That is, objected on the ground asked and answered,
right,
which is a clear loser under any, at least it could never be reversible error that a question's already been asked once before. Why didn't he say this risks opening up exactly what?
Well, I think he just failed to recognize that it would. I think the judge failed to recognize that it would. The judge repeated the question three times.
Well, I think the subsequent ones he was trying to weaken it. I mean, he was trying to control the problem that he had started to create.
Right.
So, but don't
we
have
asking the exact same question, and he got the same answer until, I guess, finally the officer clued in that the judge would like a different answer to the same question.
Correct. Aren't we faced with a plain error test here then, and not a harmless error test?
Yes. We agree with the government that defense counsel objected to specific questions but did not object to the practice.
A plain error test on this specific question. I understand you have one a general argument, and maybe that's the same, maybe that's Is that the answer to this question too? That the evaluation of this question has to be done on plain error?
This question was objected to, but not on the ground that it was going to admit.
And our cases say when you do it that way, it's plain error, right?
Right. I think as to the practice, The judge understood that this was an innovation and that this was a departure from tradition. So if it is indeed error, I think that it's plain error. It's not as if the judge didn't know that there is a traditional method and he is departing from that method. He even discussed it with the jurors, letting them know that
traditional method, no court's ever said that it's unlawful or that it's error to go away from the traditional method. So calling it plain error seems a little hard.
I think it's plain because he knew that it was an innovation, and likely he knew that it was a risky innovation if he's read all of the cases cited by the government and cited in our brief.
But he'd also know that all the circuits have upheld judges who have done this.
Yes, which...
Notwithstanding all the circuits telling the judges they shouldn't do this, which may be something we should do as well. But...
so far, all
the
circuits...
We have in front of us.
The circuits actually have reversed in some cases where they found that in that case, when those cases where jurors were just invited after every witness as a matter of course to ask questions.
Right. The one case that did it, but you've already conceded, and I think correctly, that that's not the way the judge did it here, right? The judge did do... did try to make the kind of cautionary procedures that would prevent a per se rule against this kind of thing.
Well, he did in the sense that he asked the jurors to write their questions, and the lawyers were allowed to evaluate them before they were asked. But after every witness, after the direct, the cross, the redirect, the recross, then the juror was invited to ask questions. They were not simply told, if you feel that you missed an answer, you may interject a question. Or they were invited, okay, now it's your turn. What would you like to ask?
So you do object to the way in which the judge managed this process?
I do object to the fact that the jurors were invited, that their questions were solicited after every witness, yes. I do think that he did the right thing by having them write it, by having the lawyers discuss it, and by cautioning them repeatedly that they should just disregard any question that wasn't posed to the witness.
By the way, did the court did the court advise counsel ahead of time that he would use this practice?
I don't have any information about that. I haven't seen anything in the record suggesting that he did. Or
you just don't know.
Yeah. There was some place where there was either a bench or something where the court said he was going to do this, and there was an opportunity to make objections and to discuss it and everything, though.
Yes. Yeah. When the trial began, the lawyers were informed before the jury was informed.
So let me just get this straight. Your argument that we should adopt a per se rule is to the practice, as opposed to just allowing a question if a juror in the middle of a trial, you get a message that says that one of the jurors has a question, can they ask questions? Your objection is to the you want us to do a per se rule prohibiting a trial judge from saying at the outset, you, in addition to listening to the evidence, can ask questions, and here's how we're going to set it up. That's what you're
No. Saying. No. I would like a per se rule that jurors do not ask questions, do not pose questions to the witnesses, either orally or in writing.
So that if you get a note from the jury in the middle of the trial, are we allowed to ask questions? Someone wants to know such and such. What do you want us to tell the trial judges they have to do?
The trial judges would have to say, I'm sorry, the jury is not allowed to ask questions. I will relate your concerns to the attorneys.
All right, now let me ask you about judges asking questions. Because judges asking questions have a terrible effect on the jury.
Right, and that is provided for in the federal rules of evidence. It's sometimes the subject of litigation, if the defense perceives that the judge went too far, interfered too much, but judges are permitted to ask questions. And I think that that is, that's the proper remedy to the extent that testimony is muddled or important information has been inadvertently left out. The judges can step in and take care of that.
Don't you think that when a judge asks a question that that unfairly influences the jury because the jury focuses that this is a question that the judge asks and therefore perhaps is a more important question than any of the questions asked by the lawyers?
If the judge is asking questions to clarify, you know, muddled testimony or...
This is the same. This is muddled testimony in this case, right? Because the witness, with the connivance of both the prosecutor and the defense counsel, is trying to dance around what really happened at the scene, and the lawyer and the juror is asking a fair question given that muddle. If the judge had asked the same question, wouldn't that have the same kind of problem? That it would interfere with the jury's responsibility and the responsibilities of the two lawyers?
If the judge had inadvertently elicited inadmissible testimony, that would be a problem.
No, I'm talking about the process.
But no,
I think judge questioning implicates the Sixth Amendment in the same way?
No. The judge is charged with conducting an orderly and fair trial, and it's provided for in the rules of evidence
that can't overcome the Constitution. I'm asking you whether you think that the rules of evidence are unconstitutional with respect to questioning by federal judges.
No, and I think that judges are exactly who are best equipped. They know what testimony has been limited, what testimony has been ruled inadmissible. They understand the rules of evidence, and if there's a need for clarification, they can assist in that process.
So you would see an exception if a juror in the middle of the trial asks the judge, can I ask a question? I'm confused about this. And the judge asks the question. I mean, if it was a legitimate gap of some kind or unclear area, you know, did they say 1985 or did they say 1987? Something that the judge could either instruct the jury as to what the evidence was or ask a question himself.
I think what happens in those circumstances is that the judge has the court reporter read back the testimony. And I don't think that that there's necessarily a problem in having some testimony repeated if it hasn't been clear or if a juror missed it. I don't think that this court needs to set up a rule that takes into account very rare, unusual circumstances, like a juror sort of blurting out something in the middle of a trial. And I would note that none of the other courts of appeals have said that it is per se improper, but all of them have discouraged the practice, and all of them have faced case after case where the judges continue to do it, and they must continue to try to draw that line of, you know, what is permissible juror involvement and what is impermissible juror involvement. We believe that this court should just let the district courts know that everyone has a role, and the role of the jurors is not to get involved in the trial process.
Are you making this argument here because you think the juror questions here work to the defendant's disadvantage?
I'm making the argument for two reasons. Mm-hmm. One is that I don't know how getting involved in that process might have affected the jurors.
I mean, it could have helped the defendant just as much as hurt the defendant. We just don't know.
Right. We just don't know. We know we had one juror who apparently was the author of several questions. The prosecutor made a joke about that juror. We don't know how that juror might have then influenced other jurors. Mm. So I'm I'm objecting on both grounds.
But he was acquitted on one charge.
Yes, he was.
So maybe the questions contributed to the acquittal.
Well...
We just don't know, do we?
That's possible, I suppose, but, you know, the government was faced with 50% of its witnesses on that charge saying that the defendant did not have a gun. It would have been more surprising, I think, had the jury convicted on that charge.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
But I am objecting on both levels, that some of the questions in this case were harmful to Mr. Rawlings, and that the process is improper, and we don't really know in what way it might have affected Mr. Rawlings. It's unknowable.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Ramos?
May it please the Court, Louis Ramos on behalf of the United States. The District Court did not commit plain error when it allowed jurors in this case to ask questions of the witnesses during the course of the trial. The first thing to note here is that appellant's trial counsel never raised an objection to this process. The court advised
You're pretty lucky about that, aren't you?
Well,
I mean, let me put exactly the problem that's bothering me. This question that was asked, why did you follow the defendant out of the parking lot? If the officer had answered that truthfully, he would have said, because we thought there was a narcotics deal going down. We would have had to reverse, wouldn't we, under those circumstances, if there had been an objection by the defendant, and if that had been, and if the officer had given what, in a way, he started giving is the honest answer, wouldn't that be reversible error?
Well, I think, no. Depending on whether.
So if you have a gun case and the parties have agreed that narcotics cannot be discussed in the case, and the judge asks that question, the officer says because this guy was involved in narcotics, you don't think that would be reversible error? And it was under the harmless error test because there had been an objection. That wouldn't be reversible error?
Well, I think that we would have to look at whether there were any curative instructions given by the court at that point. Asking the
It'd be a little hard to get that item back in the box.
Yes, the government would. Yes, if that answer had come out, and if the full answer, if Detective Copeland had given the full answer, yes, we were there. We were conducting an undercover narcotics investigation, and the defendant, Mr. Rawlings.
So this is an incredibly dangerous procedure that the district judge is engaged in here, which only by luck. Two forms of luck. One. Luck for the government that there wasn't an objection, and second, luck that the judge was able to cut it off before he said anything more than the incident was at the scene or something like that without using the word drugs. What's the government's position as a general matter on this? Did the government say, go ahead, fine, let's ask questions from the jury, take questions from the jury?
Well, the government didn't object to that process either. But, Your Honor, I think that the point here to what needs to be focused on is that while if the jurors, for example, some of the cases that originally dealt with this issue in other circuits, jurors were allowed to, for example, ask questions from the jury box of the witnesses out loud. And then counsel were required to object from their positions at counsel table and probably to raise the grounds for their objection. Subsequent cases, after analyzing this issue, decided that the best practice to follow is to employ certain prophylactic measures that would ensure that certain prejudicial information wouldn't come out. And in this case, the district court, Judge Walton, did apply these prophylactic measures. Questions were required to be written in writing or submitted in writing. The counsel and the court reviewed those questions at the bench and discussed any objections outside of the earshot of the jury. It was the judge who asked the questions of the witnesses, those questions that all parties deemed were allowable questions. And in this case, the actual...
The big problem is, to me anyway, is that he informs the jury at the very beginning that their role, he's changing their role. And most jurors, I would think, think they're going to be an audience. They're going to listen to evidence, and they're going to watch this unfold in front of them. And there are two problems with that, with his telling them from the beginning, no, you're going to participate to this extent. You're going to be allowed to ask questions. That changes their role from audience to participant. And the second problem is that it takes their mind off the evidence. If they're sitting there, I'm trying to analogize it to, let's say, a lecture, and a lecturer says, now I'll take questions at the end, or I'll take questions only when I'm discussing it, and so you're sitting there thinking, I've got to get my question to him. It just seems like a bad practice to make it a practice as opposed to just allowing it if the questions occur during the trial. And they do occur. And it isn't a juror blurting a question out. It's a note from the jury during deliberations, before deliberations, saying, can we ask questions? And if so, I want to ask this question.
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that it really doesn't change the jury's role as an audience or a neutral arbiter of the facts by allowing them to ask questions. And what other courts have done in reviewing whether that does actually happen is actually review on a fact or case-by-case basis, looking at the questions to determine, well, did at some point the jury go from being a neutral arbiter of the facts to a group that was taking a position, or whether one juror in particular was taking a position. Here, for example, although many courts have said or have warned that this practice is fraught with peril and could lead to results that are unwanted, those same courts have said that it is a practice, all the federal appellate courts that have considered this issue have said that it is a practice that is within the trial court's discretion. There have been numerous courts that have been asked, similar to this case, to adopt a bright line standard such as the appellant is asking here, and they've all denied that request by appellant, holding that such that authority is within a trial court's discretion. And while some courts have warned of potential pitfalls of this practice, they've also talked about how there are many benefits to this practice. I think that we've all been at lectures where perhaps the lecture wasn't, the lecture just went on, and at some point we all started to fall asleep. And courts have said that this practice is a practice that that might force the jurors to remain more attentive, to actually be engaged. And if they have a particular question about the facts, they can ask it and get that question answered.
In the Ajmal case, didn't the Second Circuit effectively establish a per se rule? In that case, the judge asks the questions only after reviewing them with the parties. And the Second Circuit basically said, it's clear that the district courts aren't paying attention to our fraught with danger exhortations, and we're just going to say you can't do it anymore.
In that case, Your Honor, the Second Circuit and Ajmal reversed that case for two reasons. One, because they thought that the jurors' questions had gone from being fact-finding questions, which are considered permissible, to questions that indicated that the jurors had taken a position in the case. Unfortunately, that case doesn't really delve into what those questions are. But there's no
analysis of prejudice, that is, of specific prejudice. The court just says we're just not going to allow it anymore.
Well, what the court then secondly holds is that they in the Second Circuit in that case held that the practice should probably be best limited to cases that are considered complex.
Right. Where'd they get that idea? A complex exception to the Sixth Amendment or the Fifth Amendment? Where did they get that from?
There was a case preceding Ajmal, the Bush case.
Yeah, where they said don't only do it in complex cases. I know, but aren't they reflecting just a general decision on their part that they don't like this and that they should have a per se rule against it?
The Second Circuit indicated that, well, among all the circuits that have considered this issue, many circuits have discussed whether complexity should be a factor in determining whether juror questions are appropriate. And even other circuits that have considered this issue post-Ajmal, while they have taken into account that Ajmal elevated the complexity issue to a much higher degree than other courts, Other courts, such as the Third Circuit, for example, which was asked post-Ajmal in 1999 to take Ajmal's holding and apply it similarly, declined to do so.
Now, I'm not suggesting that complexity is the right test. I'm actually suggesting the opposite, which is that this just when you said no circuit has adopted a per se rule, this looks to me like a per se rule, no matter how much they've dressed it up with things like complexity or not. Because in that case, the judge had done all the prophylactic. In fact, they used the word. The judge had taken all the prophylactic procedures that were required, and yet the court still struck it down.
Well, I think the Second Circuit did in Ajmal was elevate complexity. And there are two subsequent cases that followed Ajmal in the Second Circuit. And in that case, again, they applied the same standard of complexity, and they did find that because those two subsequent cases were not complex, juror questions should probably not have been asked, but they did not reverse the conviction on those grounds. They didn't hold that by allowing the jury to ask questions, that's an automatic ground for a reversal. They again looked to the questions in that case to see
in a non-complex case.
Correct.
Yeah.
They were two subsequent cases.
Why is it better for jurors to ask questions in complex cases than in non-complex cases?
Well, some courts have taken the position that that because the practice of allowing juror questions is so fraught with peril, and the reason perhaps why a court would decide to allow jurors to ask questions is because the case is long or complex and they might just get lost in the facts, that might be those sorts of circumstances might be the best circumstance in which allowing juror questions is the best practice. But I would argue, Your Honor, that every other circuit, for example, there was a case out of the Sixth Circuit in Collins where the appellant again argued a bank robbery case, where the appellant again argued that this case was not complex and that the court should look to the holding in Ajmal to find that the district court should not be allowed to allow the jurors to ask questions. And they then found complexity only one factor to be considered.
With respect to the question that was actually asked, why did you follow the defendant out of the parking lot, was that error? I'm not asking whether harmless, plain, just whether it was error.
No. And if I could be allowed to answer why. Because the parties, as the court mentioned earlier, the parties had to dance around the fact that a narcotics transaction had transpired prior to Mr. Rawlings being chased out of the parking lot. There were numerous questions, both on direct, cross, and redirect, asked by both parties to Detective Copeland. Why did he follow them? And at times he said 10 to 15 miles an hour, at some point 20 miles an hour. The court, when asking that question, the district court, was trying to get back the response from the Detective Copeland, which he had given earlier in the trial, and that is that he saw the car going out of the parking lot at a high rate of speed. Clearly, Detective Copeland at that point, because of the way the question was so open-ended, he perhaps thought, well, maybe the judge wants me to get
maybe
into
the
this.
The judge wants me to tell the truth, because up until now they had been dancing around it, and now all of a sudden he gets a question from the judge to which the only truthful answer is because there was a narcotics deal going down in the parking lot.
Well,
why isn't that error, too, for the judge at that point, knowing that the truthful answer is prejudicial and has been excluded, to ask a question that calls for that answer?
Well, even if the question was poorly phrased, the court immediately, in other words, poorly phrased in the context of knowing that there was certain evidence that was supposed to be kept from the jury, that being the narcotics transaction, perhaps the judge in that case could have actually asked a leading question or a more pointed question.
Wasn't the question error? That's why I'm asking. Not poorly phrased is not sure what that means. But my question is, isn't it error to ask a question to which the honest answer is a prejudicial one and one which has been ruled out?
Well, first, it should be noted that defense counsel did not
object. I noted that part. That's why I gave you, the first question under both the harmless error and the plain error test is it error in the first place?
Yeah, I would argue that the question in and of itself is not error. I think if the answer, if the truthful answer, if the answer that had been deemed inadmissible had been allowed, then yes, we would be in the area of error here. But the judge, sua sponte, quickly cut that answer off. The answer, the Detective Copeland, what he said was, we followed that car because of the situation or the scene that had just transpired. That does not mention any narcotics transaction whatsoever. That could just as well be a reference to the fact that the scene that had just transpired was the fact that we had just observed a car speeding out of the parking lot at a high rate of speed.
The answer was an error. I'm still a little fixated on the question, which is what bothers me about this whole process to begin with. It's one thing when the judge or the lawyers have taken a lot of time to think about what the right questions and answers are, and it's another thing when you suddenly get something from the jury that you don't have the time to think about and that gets asked. And that seems to me the risk in this area.
But, Your Honor, the court did have time to think about it because at the bench, the question that was posed, as the appellant noted in the beginning, was one of the jurors said, was there a narcotics investigation going on in the parking lot prior to the car chase? And was appellant a focus of that investigation? And the court actually said right off the bat, I'm not asking that question. Neither, and by silence, I think it's safe to assume that they agreed that question is not an appropriate question to ask. Now, the court did try to rephrase that question in a manner that it thought would elicit the testimony that had been elicited earlier while staying away from the inadmissible portion of the answer. And that is why I don't think that the question itself is error. And the parties actually did have the time and discuss, and the district court itself recognized that this was a question that it wasn't going to answer given its prior ruling. Moreover, Your Honor, this is really that question. Whether it was an inappropriate question or not, it's an evidentiary question. The appellant doesn't even, the defendant never raised that issue during the testimony. And the process, the asking of that question itself doesn't call into question the process that the district court had put into place to allow jurors to ask questions of the witnesses. By employing all of the prophylactic measures that all of the circuits that have considered this issue have deemed to be appropriate prophylactic measures to make sure that defendants' rights aren't at all abridged through this process.
All right, thank you.
Your Honor, I would just note that the appellant has not made any argument with respect to the second part, and unless the court has any questions about that, the government would submit on its brief with respect to that argument.
All right.
Thank you.
Does Roland have any time left? All right, why don't you take 2 minutes?
Judge Walton repeated the juror's question almost verbatim, and he clearly did not expect that answer. When he reported to the lawyers the question, he reported it as, why did you follow the defendant out of the parking lot if he was traveling at approximately 10 to 12 miles per hour? And then the judge answered the question himself to the attorneys. He's already said that the wheels were spinning. I'll ask him that again. That's the answer he thought that he would get, but he asked the question that no attorney would ask. Why did you follow the vehicle out of the lot? The defense attorney and the prosecutor never would have asked that why question, because they you don't ask why did you do this unless you know the answer and it's an answer that you want to get. With regard to the complex versus non-complex, I don't see any distinction between them. It's in a case like this where it was very simple, it certainly was completely unnecessary for the jurors to ask questions of the witnesses. It was a very short trial. It was a very simple trial. There were no documents in the case. There were no dates. It was simply four witnesses telling what they observed. So it was unnecessary to allow the jurors to ask questions. The government apparently agrees that the practice is fraught with peril, and our position is a practice that is fraught with peril and that is entirely unnecessary and that is inconsistent with the traditional role of jurors as impartial, passive recipients of the evidence, that there's absolutely no reason to allow juror questioning.
Thank you.
Thank you.